I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another Saturday live stream. I have a very special guest today, Dr. David Skrbina. Dr. Skrbina is the author and editor of a number of books on topics in philosophy and religion, including an anthology on panpsychism, a volume on technology, actually multiple volumes on technology, and he is the editor of the first edition of Ted Kaczynski's Technological Slavery. That's where I first heard of him, actually. The second time I heard of him, when he popped up on my radar, was he did an edition of one of Savitri Devi's books, A Son of God, her book on Akhenaten. And I have gotten to know him a little bit in recent years. He contributed a response to Countercurrents, to a review of his book on St. Paul, for instance. So, David, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Glad to be here.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your education, and your interests, and then how you got to know Ted Kaczynski, who died just basically a week ago at the age of 81?
Yeah, sure. That's a long story, but I'll just compress it down here for you. Yeah, my initial background in college as an undergraduate student was in technical fields. I was interested in math and science and physics and so forth. So I started studying those here at the University of Michigan, not far from where I was born, near Detroit. Studied the fields, moved along, was always interested in philosophy, philosophical issues. Came across a really fabulous philosopher there at Michigan. His name was Henryk Skolimowski, who was both an environmental philosopher and a philosopher of technology, in particular, a skeptical philosopher of technology. He was an early critic of technology. And he and I got to be good friends. We worked together for many years. He was kind of a mentor for me in many ways. And so I just, plowed along, got a technical degree, ended up getting a master's degree in mathematics, which in retrospect turned out to be quite helpful because it gives me a good background in technical issues. So because I studied math, science, and physics and computer programming and some other things. So I had a really good grasp of technology, certainly even better than like Skolimowski had, who did not really have that background. So in a sense, I felt like I really understood technology. I knew how things worked. I knew how electronics worked. I knew how computers worked. And I was worried because I could kind of see, even this was back in the around 1980, that things were not heading in a good direction. It was problematic for people. It was, a root cause of problems with the environment and so forth. In particular, Skolimowski put me under this book by Jacques Ellul called The Technological Society, which is really a classic work of technology critique. Ellul wrote it in 1954 in French. It was published in English in 1964. Really a monumental milestone kind of work, and just really, really a crushing critique, basically laying out technology as a kind of an autonomous, deterministic force in the world. And that kind of, I think, was one of the stimulus points for Skolimowski and then later for me as well. So I was early on, I was really a skeptic, technology critic in a sense. I wasn't really writing at that point, but still. And then, into the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, so we get this mail bombing string that's going on. Mysterious person or group are sending these sporadic mail bombs, and they're injuring people, later they're killing one or two people, ultimately three people died. At first you don't think much about it, you just think it's kind of some kind of crazy, lunatic group who's sending bombs. But then it turns out that there's actually kind of an ideology behind this. I was really surprised when some of the newspaper reports started showing up in the early 90s with this critique of technology that was behind this string of bombings. And I thought, well, this is really interesting. So this bomber is clearly not just a nutcase. He's got some motive. He knows what he's doing, and he's got some ideas behind him that are, from the little snippets, look pretty solid. So I continued to file the case, and then it was the Unabomber case and got a lot of attention, a lot of publicity. Those of you who were around in the mid-90s in the U.S. certainly know all about that. Did not get much coverage in Europe, as far as I know. But then, the demand was to publish this manifesto, the famous technology manifesto, Industrial Society and Its Future. The unknown bomber wanted it published in a high visibility venue, and he promised to stop the bombings. So it was basically blackmail, trying to blackmail the federal government. Usually that doesn't go very well, but this time it worked. And the FBI, after spending many years, decided they could not stop this guy. They could not catch him. And they recommended to Bill Clinton that he yield to the blackmail and publish the manifesto, which he did in September of 1995. So I remember I was just really, really shocked. I mean, I couldn't believe that they actually caved in. You know, you got to believe there's a lot of gnashing of teeth before they agreed to publish that thing, but they did it. They put it in the Washington Post, the entire manifesto, 30,000 words, sort of a smallish book almost. And yeah, I was shocked. I ran out, bought two copies of the paper that day. One copy I threw in my little archive file where it still is today. The other one I used to kind of cut and paste because my wife and I were immediately starting to type this thing into our computer so that we had a Word version, a digital version that we could work with and edit and do things with. So, you know, that went on for a few months. It was about 6 months after the publication that, so there's another story behind that, right? So the bomber's brother, David Kaczynski, recognizes the text, thinks it's his brother Ted, tells the FBI. The FBI arrest him in Montana. This was in April of 96, and that's how they caught him. And again, I was shocked. I remember the day, you know, you kind of wake up in the morning and here's the morning news on the radio. You know, they captured the Unabomber. Like, wow, this is surprising. And here's the guy's name, you know, Ted Kaczynski. Oh, never heard of him. And it turns out he was a PhD math professor from the University of Michigan. And I just about fell out of my bed at that point because I was a master's student in mathematics at the University of Michigan's same campus. I had some of the same professors that he did. Yeah, just I was really, really astonished that there was such a high-level academic fellow who was allegedly behind the bombings. So that, you know, that led to a year-long trial. Won't go into the details of that. Ended up doing a plea bargain for life in prison with no possibility of parole. And then that went, you know, a number of months, a number of years, actually. After that, I completed my PhD in philosophy. Started teaching, got a teaching job at a campus of the University of Michigan. I was teaching, among other things, philosophy of technology, and that sort of led me full circle back to TED and the manifesto.
So when did you start corresponding with the man?
Yeah, so right, I started, I guess it was late 2003, and I was starting to compile material for this new course in philosophy of technology that I was creating. And I was going to include the manifesto, which was already out there and available. But it had been, 4 or 5 years at that point, since 6 years, something like that, since we'd heard from Ted. He was locked away. Nobody said anything about him. We didn't know what he was doing, what he was thinking. Was he alive or dead? I mean, obviously, we would have heard that. But no one was really saying anything. It was kind of a media blackout, kind of a total censorship as far as I could tell. So I figured the only way to find out for sure was to write directly to him. So I got an address for the Supermax prison in Colorado, wrote him a letter, university letterhead, and just said, hey, I'm a professor at your university, and I'm teaching a course on technology, and I have some questions for you. So I reeled off a list of questions, you know, just basic things like, you know, any thoughts on the manifesto in the recent years and what are your new ideas and have you written anything else new and so forth? And yeah, never expected a response. I'd never written to a prisoner before, didn't know how that was going to work. But about a month later, got a long handwritten letter from Ted giving nice, lengthy, detailed answers to all my questions. And that was kind of the the kickoff of a real back and forth process, questions and answers and queries and challenges, and eventually leading to the production of a book. And yeah, many letters over several years. I think I've got about 150 letters from him in total. So yeah, it was really a remarkable and a very fruitful interaction.
I believe I wrote to him in 2000. I started doing research towards a book on environmentalism from the right. And I recalled having read his manifesto when it was first published and made notes on it that was critical of the left. It was critical of the left, and it was also somewhat Nietzschean and vitalist in its analysis of human nature. And I thought, okay, well, this fellow broadly fits into this rightist, anti-technological, radical environmental paradigm that I was working out that included people, I thought, like Martin Heidegger and Savitri Devi. And so I wrote a couple of letters to him. He was kind of crabby with me. In the first letter, I recall that he was very annoyed that I was implying that he was actually the author of technological society and its future. Apparently, he hadn't admitted to that fact yet or didn't want to say anything that would sort of officially admit to that. He sort of unwound a little bit in the second letter, but I don't have the letters handy, unfortunately, but I recently glanced at them and I thought, gosh, what a missed opportunity. I should have persevered with this. But what happened is I was finishing my doctorate at the time, and I had to prepare for basically getting a job. And so I sort of set all of this aside and I never returned to it. I still want to write this book on ecofascism, which is the title I've chosen for it, but I have to wait till I retire, I suppose, before I get back to that. And I missed my opportunity, but I was very interested to note that other people had been querying him about this and that he wrote a little rejoinder to it, which I linked in the post at Countercurrents, and we could talk about that a little later. Let me ask you, what were the things that you thought were most profound about his manifesto, and what are some of the limits in your view of his thinking?
Right. Well, you know, I thought when I read it the first time through, a couple of things struck me initially. It was the first thing was the lengthy lead-in against leftism. So there's a large chunk of the beginning of the manifesto that doesn't even talk about technology at all. He's really critiquing leftists and leftist ideology and how dangerous it is. And, you know, it's hazardous to any sort of revolutionary movement for various reasons, because leftists are over-socialized and so forth. And then he's going into the power process and kind of these psychological issues. And I remember reading like, wow, you know, I'm several thousand words into this thing. And like, he didn't even mention technology yet. So clearly that was important for him, and that he thought he had to put that up front. I think at some point I asked him about that. He said basically he wanted to drive off any leftists before they even got to the meat of the manifesto. So that's why he put that stuff up front. But when I got to the arguments about technology, I could see a lot of similarity to Ellul, to Jacques Ellul. So the arguments were very familiar. I mean, he was bringing up familiar arguments and points. He was putting them in a relatively recent context of the early 90s. But they were similar arguments that we would see in Ellul. In fact, I remember thinking I was surprised because he quotes some experts in the manifesto, but he does not even mention Ellul. And I think I asked him about that later as well. And he said something like, you know, Ellul was just kind of the overarching force for this whole thing. And he would have quoted him too much or something like that. He gave a little bit of a sideways excuse about why he didn't mention Ellul. But so the arguments were familiar to me. I was impressed by the manifesto's clarity. So it's very straightforward, very, very bland and matter of fact. I mean, he got criticized by some for being too bland, but I mean, this is not a bomb throwing lunatic here. He's trying to make a reasoned argument, and he does it in a very clear and straightforward in a dispassionate way. So I gave him credit for that. And the other striking thing was the forcefulness of the revolutionary conclusion. So he's of course, one of the key points is that technology cannot be reformed. You can't fix it. You can't just keep the good stuff that you like and get rid of the bad stuff. That just doesn't work for theoretical and practical reasons. And therefore, his conclusion was that basically we have to revolt against the system, which is undermining it or destroying it in some sense, or large portions of it, as the only hope of really saving human dignity and saving planetary destruction. So that was a pretty striking conclusion. Again, that was not totally unique. There were other earlier thinkers who had talked about the need for revolution, Herbert Marcuse and Ivan Illich, even Lewis Mumford in a couple of different ways talked about sort of destroying the mega machine. So those ideas had kind of been out there for a while. I mean, it's a very old, it goes back to Samuel Butler in the 1850s. I mean, he talks about destroying machines back then. So there's actually kind of a long history, certainly within the Luddite movement, they're destroying machines. So there's a long history of even of thinkers calling for destruction of technology. But, you know, again, Ted does it in a very forceful, direct way. There's no apology. There's no, you know, no punches are pulled. He just goes straight at it. And that was a pretty impressive thing as well. If there are some limitations or, let's say, problems or shortcomings with the manifesto, I mean, it's hard to criticize because he says a lot in his 30,000 words. Obviously, you can't say everything. Even in a book-length treatment, you can't really address every issue in detail. But, I mean, there are a couple of things that sort of bothered me. He talks about the system, the technological system, and it's never really defined in any meaningful sense. It's just sort of understood, but it's a pretty important concept, and I think he should have elaborated on that. And then sort of something about the process by which a revolution is going to happen. He mentions a few little things at the end about general strategic suggestions, but doesn't really seem to grapple in a detailed or precise way with what exactly that would mean, what that entails, how one would go about doing it, and so forth. So there were some sort of things that were lacking, you know, obviously points of elaboration that we might have liked to see. But all in all, I mean, he did a spectacular job. I mean, really laid out the case against technology in very blunt and clear terms and drove everyone, the reader, to the logical conclusion. So it was overall really an impressive effort.
So one thing that struck me about this book upon rereading it, I did a podcast, a live stream with Richard Hauck about it a couple of years ago, and I was rereading it for that occasion. And it struck me that he's actually rather anthropocentric in his approach, or humanistic in his approach. He's really arguing against technology from the point of view of how it undermines human happiness, which I thought was interesting. He doesn't take a non-anthropocentric or ecocentric or deep ecological approach to values in his argument. I thought that was quite interesting. Another thing, though, about it is that he seems to have a pretty much naturalistic understanding of man. It's almost an Epicurean analysis of human desires and human happiness that reminded me of Rousseau, actually. It reminds me of Rousseau's Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, which is a critique of civilization. It's not just a critique of technological civilization. It's a critique of all forms of civilization, really, because anything that gets too far away from easily satisfied, naturally given needs becomes a source of alienation for human beings. And ultimately for Rousseau, it drives the creation of, drives oppression. And I thought that was an interesting sort of limit to his outlook, because even Rousseau in his other writings wants to give a defense of civilization by saying that, yes, it does alienate us from our simple animal needs, but it also provides an opportunity for us to actualize our higher capacities, including the capacity to create culture, including the capacity to philosophize, things like that. And it just didn't strike me that he has understanding of man that could treat things like philosophy or art or science as really valid expressions of human nature. Just, I think he treats them sort of as fake surrogates for more easily satisfied material demands or material needs.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, on the anthropocentrism, I mean, Ted is very pragmatic. That was his driving focus, right? He's a practical guy. He wants to get things done. He wants to achieve a revolution of some kind. So he's taking the most practical approach. I suspect that he thinks most people are anthropocentric, which probably they are. They're thinking in terms of human interest or their own interest and so forth. So I suspect that he's crafting an argument to appeal to most readers who are thinking in terms of human well-being and human suffering. It's a relatively small group who put preeminently environmental concerns or, you know, concerns of nature or animal rights or so forth, or put that above their own. He does seem to have some sympathies that way. There's a couple of points in the manifesto where he says, you know, I think it's highly important that technology is damaging the environment, but I'm not going to talk a lot about that here. You know, so he kind of just puts it off the side. He doesn't dispute it, but he doesn't really elaborate on it. I think he feels he has a stronger point, stronger case to make when he focuses on the harms to human beings. But you're right. I mean, in terms of these other sort of cultural activities and so forth, right, surrogate activities and whatnot. So you're right. I mean, a lot of things, I mean, almost everything could count for Ted as a kind of a surrogate activity, which is problematic. I mean, almost anything you do, right, you know, academically, your job, unless it's directly aimed at acquiring food, shelter, or clothing, almost anything, you know, has a surrogate aspect to it, if you will. So that was maybe another problematic issue. You know, he doesn't really value those things very much. He never really put much weight in philosophy. I mean, he knew I was a philosopher, but he didn't seem to give much credence to that. You know, later when I wrote my book, The Metaphysics of Technology, you know, he really had no real interest in anything like metaphysics, because that's sort of abstract and obscure and has no bearing on a practical revolution. So, I mean, that's just kind of how he was thinking. To me, it was necessary to complete the picture, because you don't really know what you're dealing with until you understand the metaphysical basis of this phenomenon that you're grappling with. So I thought it was essential, but Ted's his pragmatic side always won out in that case.
Did you share this book with him? Did you get his impressions of your work?
I sent him a paper, a copy of my work, The Metaphysics of Technology, when it was just nearing publication in 2015. So I sent him a full copy. You know, he kind of said, thanks, but don't send me tons of paper because I have nowhere to keep it. I mean, he was kind of more worried again about the pragmatic stuff. Like, I sent him like, you know, a 300-page stack of papers, and he's like, oh my God, I have nowhere to put this stuff, and I've got to get rid of things, and don't send me that much again, please. And I don't know if he actually read it or not. I was kind of hoping he would, but I never really got the impression that he did.
One question that I have to follow up, if Kaczynski's arguments are basically criticizing the technological system because it has a negative impact on human happiness, that really invites the question, well, if we're really concerned with human happiness, how is the Earth's current population going to fare if we crash the technological system? Won't that create a great deal of unhappiness, especially among the people, the billions of people who are alive today? How many people can Earth sustain at a much more primitive level of technology? And what are you going to do with the surplus? And doesn't their happiness matter at all?
Right. So those are really good questions. I've long been worried about the population question, and I ran that by Ted a couple of times. In the manifesto, he says a couple of things like, well, there's one passage, I forget exactly where it was, but he says something like, is it cruel? Someone could say it's cruel to work for the destruction of the system because it will cause human suffering. And he says, well, look, there's suffering going on right now because the system is causing people to suffer. It's going to get worse in the future. So the suffering is going to increase. And with more people suffering more, there's more total suffering. That was one of his points. Secondly, he says, you know, if you, there's a good likelihood the system is going to collapse anyway, just because of the intrinsic instabilities of the system. If it collapses down the road when we have, you know, 10 billion people, that's going to be worse than if it collapses with there's 8 billion people or 6 billion people, which would be better. So the point was the sooner that a collapse occurs, the better, because it affects fewer people, which is also true. And probably the third point is you got to look in the very long run, right? Yeah, so short-term suffering. Yeah, I mean, if there's a rapid collapse, which is not a necessary condition of this sort of collapse scenario. Ted says it could be a gradual process, but if it was rapid collapse, then lots of people would die pretty quickly. But it's not clear that in the long run, that's going to lead to more suffering, right? More short-term suffering, but you know, long-term could be clear net gain, depending how far into the future we look. Even a lot smaller number of people on the planet, but if they're living a very satisfactory existence, could quickly outweigh the cost to some millions or billions who might die or suffer in the short run. So I think there's some pretty good arguments against that. I know I was sort of worried about overpopulation in general. And I raised the question to Ted. I said, you know, I've argued myself against population and argued for population decrease and for, you know, lower population totals on the earth. And Ted's like, well, that's a waste of time because nobody wants to talk about, you know, getting rid of people. Nobody wants to go around blaming pregnant women because they, you know, because they're the source of all these babies that are coming along. And so he's like, well, that's a loser argument. So don't waste your time. That was his view. So it was kind of interesting. I mean, I understood his point, but he, you know, he seemed to acknowledge, yeah, in any revolutionary collapse scenario, there'd be a lot fewer people, and that's the way it has to go. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Can you explain to the audience and to me what it means to say that technology has become an autonomous system? Most people think that we control technology. We are the ones who buy our cell phones and talk on it. We're the ones who use hammers to hammer. We're the ones who use frying pans to fry. We're using technology, and it seems odd to say that, well, technology is not something that we ultimately control. It is an autonomous self-reinforcing system that has escaped our control. That's something that I first took from Elul. I first encountered this in Ernst Jünger. And then I encountered this in Elul. And I think it's a hard idea for a lot of people to grasp and to accept.
Yes, it's true, because it looks like people do all the work of technology. We do the inventing, we do the building, we do the planning, we do the implementing. So on one level, yes, the technology is dependent on people. I mean, if something, you know, there's some weird solar flare of fantastic proportions and it killed every human being on Earth, then the technological system would collapse. So there's no two ways about that. The point, though, is that no one person or no group of people can exert a kind of control over the process. Because the process is diffused among so many millions and billions of people with different motives and different driving forces and different resources at their disposal and so forth, aspects of the system just kind of ratchet upwards. And any one person, any one group, you know, any individual scientist can die, and another scientist steps in and carries forward that work, right? Any corporate leader, any military leader, any one person, there is nobody who's indispensable, because aspects of the technological development go on in a million parallel paths. because it has so many different, it's like the internet itself, right? It's diffused through a million different parallel structures, and you can't really chop off any one of them and stop the thing. So the technology, for multiple reasons, for, you know, financial reasons, power reasons, you know, pure interest, military reasons, profit, and so forth, many people from many different sides are all pressing ahead in various aspects of technology, which means that all parts of the system are kind of inching forward in many different ways all at the same time. There's no overarching control. There's no directing process. It's a million people doing a million different little things every day in, you know, in scientific labs and in papers and research and garages and wherever they're tinkering and doing their stuff, you know, laboratories and so forth. Everybody's inching this whole process forward. And so short of obliterating all the people, getting rid of all of them, which would seem to be impossible, or some kind of massive war. I mean, there's a point at the beginning of Lul's book where he says, you know, total nuclear war might actually collapse the system. You know, if you could really, really sort of devastate the industrial societies of the world, that might cause things to sort of collapse. But it's just this diverse, paralleled structure of technological advance that the system as a whole, because it has so many diffused parallel paths of development, moves ahead sort of no matter what. There's nothing we can do, any one person can do, any 10 people can do. There's nothing the president can do. It's a really a troubling scenario. And I think we're starting to get the feel for that with this AI stuff. And that's sort of been in the news lately, this advanced AI. People sort of, you know, stupidly are just finally figuring out, like, oh, shoot, this could be a problem, which, you know, we've been saying for decades. And they're realizing that there's actually not much we can do to stop this stuff, which is going to be bad news in itself. So it really is kind of striking how the whole technological evolution, the whole system as a whole, moves ahead, regardless of what anyone wants, regardless of what we think, regardless of what we might like. And in that sense, it is an autonomous process.
It strikes me that technology is somewhat like language. We think that we use language, but when we think about when did we begin using language is already there. It's sort of one of the things that's in the background all around us that conditions how we think and how we act. And therefore, it's hard to say that we control it. We don't actually have a sort of an external viewpoint on it. We are thrown into a world. We learn a language. We're surrounded by technology. Technology is constantly developing. There are so many things going on in technology that no one mind can comprehend at all. And yet we have this feeling that, well, you know, I choose to use the smartphone or not. But already there, it's sort of like the weather. It's sort of like the boundaries of our world. It's something that we don't really have a position to comprehend or understand it. It's sort of like the outer horizon of experience in some ways. And that's interesting. But there's this idea that, well, can't we use this wisely? People say that, okay, well, medicine can be used to cure or to kill. We have ethics, therefore, to guide doctors in their activities. So to make sure that their technical expertise is used for good ends. We have other professions which have technical skills, and to guide them, they have ethical codes. Isn't it possible for human beings to wisely guide and take control of technology and use it for the greater good, or not use it, discard certain forms of technology? Why is that not possible? Why would Kaczynski disregard that? And I know he disregards it or dismisses that.
Well, right. So some people point to specific technologies. Let's say, for example, nuclear weapons. And we say, well, look, you know, we saw how horrendous that was. We used them once. The U.S. did on civilian populations in World War II. decided that was terrible and don't want to use those again. So we kind of have global agreements and we try to limit their spread. And so far, it seems like it's worked, right? There's been no second use of nuclear weapons since the war. But in a sense, it hasn't worked because the nuclear proliferation continues. More countries are on the verge of getting nuclear weapons, right? We know about Iran and their process to acquire nuclear weapons. They'll probably have it at some point. And of course, there's a constant threat of use. So even though the nuclear weapons so far have not been detonated, they've been used countless times, most recently with Russia, right? Putin obviously has lots of nuclear weapons and he can play the nuclear card anytime he wants. And he's moving weapons into Belarus and so forth. So they become used in that sense. They don't become used as a tool of physical destruction, but they become used as tools of coercion. And it's almost certain at some point somebody will do something stupid and they'll actually be used. So then there goes that argument down the drain. But in any case, even if we had a perfect solution to nuclear weapons, you know, or completely ban them, that's just one tiny slice of the technological monstrosity that we're dealing with. And there's so many angles and so many, you know, potent weapons and so many disaster scenarios that you can't really even begin to tackle all of those all at once. Human beings just can't do that. We aren't able or incapable, haven't got the bandwidth to tackle multiple complex problems all at the same time, let alone coming to agreement and enforcing agreements and so forth. I mean, even benign things. So you mentioned like medical technologies, and it seems like, well, that's a good thing, right? That we have new medical technologies and we can treat cancer and we can, you know, cure things and keep people alive and, you know, keep, you know, solve childhood illnesses and, you know, all those nice little things. But even the good stuff isn't an unambiguous good with technology. So, for example, we know that medical technologies have been a large reason why the total population on the earth is now 8 billion people. That and alone is an ecological disaster. There's no future scenario in which the planet can handle 8 billion people. And of course, it's increasing. We're heading towards 9 and 10 billion rapidly. So the good of technology, the medicine, allowed us to go from 4 billion to 6 billion to 8 billion to soon to be 10 billion people, which is destroying the planet. So we would have been actually far better off, and the planet would have been vastly better off if we didn't have our medical technologies, if people died younger and of more common things, and if you know, infant mortality was more of its natural level that it used to be for the human species. And you know, you kind of hate to sort of glorify these kind of, you know, tougher conditions, but nature puts these conditions on us for a reason, and that keeps every species in balance. There's always a balance between food supplies and predators, right? Predator-prey relationships and abilities of the environment to supply the needs of different species. So, you know, we've usurped those bounds of nature with our technologies, and it's leading us to a disaster. So there's almost no unalloyed goods that come from technology. They're short-term goods. Some people profit immensely, so I guess it's good for them. But larger picture, high-level view, long-term, there's almost nothing good that comes from advanced technology.
Well, it strikes me that one can make the argument, yes, that everything can be used for good or ill, and that's why we need to use things wisely for the good. However, the weakness of that when it comes to global technology is that it really seems to presuppose that we'd have to have some sort of global government that could basically regulate technology. Because if you have multiple competing jurisdictions, these groups will say, yes, of course, we should limit nuclear weapons. And then they'll quietly be working as quickly as possible to build them anyway, because that's advantageous. They won't pay lip service to global interests and, you know, the common good of the planet. And because they are particular entities with competing interests with other particular entities, they're going to be furiously working on dangerous technologies, things like artificial intelligence, things like nuclear weapons, biological weapons and so forth. And so if your solution to any problem is first have global government, it's not really a solution because I don't think we're going to get there anytime soon. And once we have global government, what does that mean? The whole globe is going to be controlled by politicians. That doesn't seem like a recipe for wisdom either. So it strikes me as problematic just because of the fact that we have all these competing entities on the planet that will definitely use technology to gain an edge over one another, even though they know better, even though they think this could be a total disaster, they'll think, well, the other guys are doing it, so we can't fall behind. We can't give up this potential destructive force because other people won't.
That's exactly right. And that's another argument why technology is an unstoppable process. When you read the works of even the pro-tech people like Ray Kurzweil, and he talks about all the wonderful benefits of technology, and then you get him, you press him into a corner, you say, well, what about all those bad things? And he's like, yeah, but you know, and then he uses this nice little phrase, we have no choice. And I can't tell you how many times I came across this phrase in tech writers, we have no choice, for exactly what you said, right? Well, we can't do it because then the Russians and the Chinese will do it. Or, you know, company A can't do this because then company B and company C will eat our lunch because they'll advance those things. There's a million reasons, you know, profits, power, competitive reasons, prestige, and so forth, that the argument comes down to, well, you know, we have no choice. We have to do this. And that's technological determinism. I mean, it could hardly be blunter than that.
Right.
In very brute terms, we have no choice. We have to do it. You know, some guys will say it's good and we have no choice. Some people will say it's bad and we have no choice, but everybody agrees we have no choice. Okay. So there's your technological determinism. It's being driven forward. It will be driven forward. And there's almost nothing that we can do about it. You are right. I mean, right. If it's like any arms agreement or something, you need high level agreement if you're going to try to disrupt that process or slow it down or pause it. Ted Kaczynski himself was not optimistic, right? He said the system is too strong, it's too robust, there's too much of this, you know, we have no choice kind of thinking going on. Technology is developing too many parallel paths. He said, you know, right now, no, we can't do anything. We can't do anything to disrupt that process. But he says the process is sort of spinning out of control. It's driving populations, like I said, through the roof. It's threatening global ecological collapse, threatening a number of sort of other disaster scenarios, which might in themselves threaten the process of development of the system. So Ted says, you know, any revolutionary actions should try to increase the instability in the system to bring us closer to this sort of spontaneous breakdown, which is really the best that we can probably hope for at this point because of all these reasons that we just talked about. So, you know, right now it's just a matter of watching, looking for the weak points, heightening the instabilities, you know, trying to bring that day when it collapses sooner rather than later, because conceivably there are thresholds that we might cross. You know, we've talked, some thinkers have talked about this singularity, Kurzweil and others, sort of, you know, where they sort of get super AI combined with ability of it to build itself and create its own computers. And then the thing is really running autonomously. And then sort of we might literally lose complete physical control of the process. And then that's almost certainly a catastrophe. So we have this little window of time between now and this singularity point, which Kurzweil has been saying is coming at 2045. So maybe we have, 20 years, maybe, at which the system could still collapse. We might hope it still collapses, and maybe we might actually work for its collapse in whatever little ways we can, because that might be the only saving grace, because once it hits true autonomy, then it's a whole new ballgame, and it may be sort of literally impossible to stop at that point.
Yeah, that's very disturbing. We have a question here from Maybe Next Time. He sends $3. Thank you. He says, hello, Greg and Dave. What level of tech was Ted accepting of? That's an interesting question.
That's a good question. I myself put that question to him. I know he started the beginning of the manifesto with the words that the Industrial Revolution has been a disaster for the human race. When I read that, he said, oh, well, he wants us to go back in time to simpler technology prior to the Industrial Revolution, right? So maybe technology of the year 1700, right? Or maybe 1600, just to be safe. And I put that to him. He's like, oh, no, we can't control that. We can't choose a point in time. We have to just sort of, you know, just blow up the whole system, watch it all collapse. And that will basically take us back to hunter-gatherers or something very close to that, maybe very small-scale farming. And that's where we need to go. So when I pressed him, he was a proponent of this sort of nomadic hunter-gatherer existence, really kind of the core mode of human existence for 99% of human history, right? If you go back, say, almost 3 million years to the genus Homo, 99% of the time we were hunter-gatherers, and that was sustainable, and the species survived and the planet flourished. So basically, Ted says, you know, we just need to blow up the system, drive us back to hunter-gatherers, and just sort of take what comes.
We also have a question from ABC, who sends $10. Thank you. Deindustrialization and de-technologization of the West, perceived as white, is a long-sought goal of the non-whites in the global left, with the sole purpose of dominating the white race. Unilateral deindustrialization is suicide. Ted was not our guy, was he? How good a mathematician was he? Okay, those are two questions, I guess. Well, this question speaks to the issue of that we already discussed, which is you can't deindustrialize unilaterally because other people will just take advantage of it. And therefore has to be global. There has to be a global stepping back from technological civilization. It can't be just done by one group of people because, if one group of people surrenders to technological advantages, they'll just be taken advantage of by other people who will press their advantage in those circumstances. So I guess the other question is, how good a mathematician was he? Or maybe that's just a flippant question. Did you ever talk about mathematics in your correspondence?
Very passing. I published one or two little articles on mathematics. I think I sent Ted a copy early on just to say, hey, look, I can do this too. Of course, I was not nearly, he was a brilliant mathematician. I mean, his PhD thesis was really remarkable. There's some quotes from his advisors at the time, like, you know, only 10 people in the country probably understood his dissertation. So yeah, Ted was brilliant. He was a brilliant mathematician. But when he stopped, he was done. And, you know, I asked them some questions about, you know, technical, I think I was doing research on sequences and series. He's like, yeah, I don't even want to talk about that. So when he was done, he was just finished. So, I mean, he didn't lose the ability, but he just had zero interest in talking about math. But sort of the ethnic racial issue is a good question, right? He says in the manifesto that it needs to be a global revolution, as you say, because you can't do bits and pieces if we sort of revolt here and the Chinese don't, then they're going to come and just mow us down or something. So he wants the different peoples of the world, the different races and ethnic groups, at least their revolutionary wings, to work together to make it a global anti-tech revolution. So if you're looking out for your own ethnic or racial group, you're not likely to work very well with others. B, you're likely to sort of have additional conflicts that will be racial or ethnic conflicts that will distract you from the main task, which is getting rid of technology. So that's why Ted was sort of against any sort of focus on, you know, white interests, white nationalism, or any nationalism, any special interests. He was, in a sense, he was against racism in that sense. Even though he did say some sort of detrimental things about blacks, but, you know, we won't go into those. But I think he...
Well, we could, but let's set that aside for now. We actually have a question from Reed Johnson. David, what do you believe was the nature... He sends $10. Thank you. David, what do you believe was the nature of the three-year-long experiments Ted participated in at Harvard as an undergrad with psychologist Henry Murray. Who was Henry Murray and what were his motivations? And did this curious experience have any effect on the ultimate trajectory of Ted's life?
I think the short answer is no. I mean, Ted was involved in some of these early campus experiments. Not really even experiments. I mean, people think, you know, like they wired his head with electrodes and they, you know, put him in some deprivation room for, you know, days on end or something. It was nothing like that. They were studying effects of stress, psychological stress on undergraduate students. So, and I've seen transcripts of these things. So Murray would bring undergraduates in and he would have them talk about their ideas or their own particular views of the world. And then he would start attacking them. And he would say, well, that's a stupid idea. And what are you, an idiot? You know, he's like insulting them, you know, showing them that they can't really justify because they're undergraduate students, you know, they're not PhD guys yet. So, and just shooting holes, trying to demean them, trying to shoot them down. And then he was gauging their response, right? How were these students reacting to this personal assault on them and their ideas? Were they taking it personally? Were they giving intellectual responses? Were they just clamming up, right? As far as I can tell, this seemed to be the extent of the experiments that were going on at the time. It was hardly anything nefarious. It was hardly scarring or whatever people want to say. If anything that I've seen, it had basically zero impact on Ted, except maybe to cause him to further dislike authorities and further distrust the system, as if he didn't have reasons already. But, you know, people play that up. What's troubling is people play up these sort of, you know, little experiments that he underwent at Harvard because they want to find an excuse why he went so extreme in his anti-tech, why he sent bombs, why he killed three people. They just can't believe that it's because this danger of technology was so great that someone might actually use that as a driving force. People had to have some other excuse. You know, right. Well, it must have been these MK Ultra experiments, or it must have been, you know, abuse. He was tortured as a kid, or, you know, his mother dropped him on his head when he was two, or, you know, he had some kind of encephalitis, which caused some mental illness. And they're really right. Seeking these excuses rather than saying, no, actually, he was completely lucid and rational. And he understood that technology was a mortal threat to the planet. And that was a good enough reason. People just don't want to hear that. So they're always hunting around for these other crazy excuses.
Yeah, I think that's really true. It's very unusual for people to believe in their ideas so strongly that they're willing to kill or die for them. And we live in a society where when you encounter a person like that, they want to come up with some kind of medical explanation for that because, frankly, the truth is just too frightening. That people take ideas so seriously they're willing to kill or die over them. Maybe we should think more seriously about these things too. People flinch at that. I understand the desire to do that. I do think it's tremendously important to contemplate what AI promises. The AI boosters are talking about a point where technology does become completely autonomous. It completely slips control. And at that point, we are completely at its mercy. And it becomes not just technology as a kind of blind and stupid process, but technology having its own intelligence, its own guiding intelligence that's different from human intelligence and can evolve so rapidly that within minutes, it could be as different from us as we are from one-celled organisms. The idea that human beings are eagerly pursuing this point just strikes me as complete, sheer, utter madness. We're talking about creating a successor life form to control the Earth. I don't think that can ever end well. Unless we think that we're creating a benevolent God, I hardly think that that's within the capacity of human beings to do. So my thoughts about Kaczynski and his bombing campaign. As I've been reading more about AI, I just wonder, could he have postponed the singularity for a few days or hours? Couldn't that be a justification for what he did? I'm sure in his own mind, he would think absolutely yes.
Yeah. I mean, again, very, very pragmatic guy. Anything that can put off a disaster in that sense, in the long term, he's willing to sort of buy time if that's what it would take. So, you know, he didn't, I don't know that I'm trying to remember if any of the letters, if it really talked about kind of this AI takeover thing, because it's an interesting scenario specifically that we're facing now that I don't know if that he really grappled with that one. But yeah, it does seem like madness. I mean, Ted talked about people like Kurzweil and so forth who are pushing forward on the technology. Like, these people are criminals. I mean, they're either criminally insane or they're rationally criminal, but they're pushing ahead technologies and promoting technologies that could, you know, obliterate all life on the planet. And, you know, what's their excuse? Like, oh, we're, you know, are they so arrogant to think, oh, we'll just put in safeguards and we'll have kill switches and we'll be able to stop this thing? And, you know, they just think that they're just so, you know, like, I want to upload my mind into the computer so I can live forever. Like,
that is, that seems to be one of the things that really drives us forward. And on the surface, I think we should be alarmed simply about that. The people who want to become immortal, they're de facto, they will become tyrants. Already, old people have a huge disproportionate amount of power. Imagine old people that never die. Imagine being, you know, a child of 14 in a society ruled by people who are 2,000 years old and counting. It'd be basically like being ruled by, you know, capricious Olympian deities or something like that. It would be a form of tyranny that you could never overthrow. I think any desire to prolong human life extraordinarily is ipso facto a declared desire to be a tyrant over all the rest of humanity who would be younger than you. Because one of the things that happens when people die is that power and wealth shift, right? And then the next generation has some space. But if the wealthy and powerful, and they're going to be the ones who would take advantage of this first, if the wealthy and powerful never die, that is going to be a profound form of tyranny. And people should react against that like they would any other proposal to establish some kind of profound tyranny. They should rebel.
Well, you're right. I mean, you know, Ted actually, he talked about that. He had even a more fundamental issue. And he basically said, it's not going to work. I don't care how much money and power you have now and how nifty your thing is. He says, you know, even if you could sort of, you know, upload some semacular, you know, entity that's, you know, some kind of parallel structure to your brain or something. He says, whatever AI system is running at the time, it's not going to care about you, right? Whatever your folder that your, you know, your mind is in. You know, the AI that's running the operating systems is just going to go delete because I need that space and click, you're gone. I mean, you know, the AI would be so powerful at that point. It would have zero interest in keeping, you know, you alive as you, or, you know, Kurzweil alive as Kurzweil. You know, it might, you know, might take aspects of people for study or something, or historical, you don't even know. I mean, we're so out of the ballpark at that point that there's no reason to believe that, you know, a person with a, you know, like you want to live like you are now, you as you with your memories, and you're just kind of going to live forever, and I'm just going to build up lots of great memories and have lots of knowledge or power. I mean, the odds are basically 0% that that could even happen, even in the best scenarios. So you know, Ted is like, this is a fool's mission to even try to do this. Let alone, like you say, even if you could do it, you know, think about the horrible imbalances and inequities that would follow from that. So it's a double, triple loser to even think about doing that.
Yeah, the madness of the COVID epidemic, I think, had to do with the fact that in the West, power is in the hands of increasingly old and frail people who were scared to death of this bug and were willing to engage in all kinds of tyranny and expensive follies just to keep these plebs and their germs away from them. Imagine being ruled by people who are, imagine if Chuck Schumer were 1,000 years old and Amy, you know, all these gerontocrats, we would have a 1,000-year-old Joe Biden shambling around. That's a truly dystopian prospect.
I still trip and fall.
Oh yeah, but you know, there would be robots that would be there to catch.
There you go, robot. A robot would trip and fall for him. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. There's a contradiction in this critique of nationalism or ecofascism that Kaczynski wrote in 2000, with some of his writings earlier, especially a piece on the system's greatest trick. I think that's the name of it. Is a critique of leftism, basically. And I just want to run this by you. I had a sort of brainstorm about this today. It's a piece called The System's Neatest Trick, which is, well, you edited it. It's in Technological Slavery. But this piece, Ecofascism, an Aberrant Branch of Leftism, I'd like to take partial credit, at least, for people asking him about ecofascism because, well, it was part of my agenda for corresponding with him. I knew it would be inevitable. The ecofascists, as I understand that term, this is Kaczynski, share at minimum two traits. They do not advocate total rejection of modern technology. Instead, they want to create a society in which technology will be limited and wisely used in such a way as to ensure the ecological health of our planet. They support, if not white supremacism, then at least white separatism. And he basically goes on to say that, okay, there's a paragraph here. Any movement that aims to limit technology has to be worldwide because if technological progress is cut back in one part of the world while another part of the world continues to follow the path of unrestrained technological development, then the fully technological pact, maybe that's part of the world, will have a vast preponderance of power over the less technological part. Sooner or later, probably sooner, the fully technological part of the world will take control of the other part in order to exploit its resources. Then he goes on, for obvious reasons, a white supremacist movement cannot be worldwide, even if a movement does not claim superiority for any one race or culture, but merely insists on keeping the world's various races and cultures separate and distinct. It will not be able to bring technology under control because its separatist attitude will inevitably promote rivalry and or suspicion among the various races and ethnic groups. And then he goes on to say that, therefore, he believes that for there to be a global revolt against technology, the anti-tech revolution has to be anti-nationalist and anti-racialist. So he says, every movement that seeks to limit technology must make every effort to minimize divisions or differences among races or ethnic groups. Purely as a matter of strategy, racial and cultural blending must be promoted. So take that, you ecofascists. Okay, that's a clear statement, and I can understand his rationale. But in this essay he wrote on the system's greatest trick, which it's just sort of a continuation of his critique of leftism. And in there he argues that political correctness and leftist crusades against things like, masculinity, against things like ethnocentrism, against racism and things like that. These are all part of the system. The system, just like Kaczynski, wants to blend away differences amongst people. And therefore, I would conclude that anything that agitates against these attitudes that everything must be blended, we must break down barriers, we must break down ethnocentrism, we must break down barriers to racial intermarriage and cultural mingling and homogenization, anything that would promote those boundaries being strong would be contrary to the global dominance of technological society. So if that's his analysis in his piece on the system's greatest trick, wouldn't people who are agitating for ethnocentrism actually be impeding globalization and the global technological system. Now, they are not necessarily part of the movement that he envisions against technology, right, which he says has to be global and as global and homogeneous as the global technological system, apparently. These people aren't part of that movement as he envisions it, but what they are forces that work against the completion of this global homogeneous technological system, and therefore wouldn't Kaczynski have to applaud these retrograde forces like sexism and ethnocentrism and the desire to marry one's own kind and things like that? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, right. So that raises some good points. I think there's a kind of basic distinction, strategic distinction between an accelerationist type approach and a, let's say, hitting the brakes kind of approach, right? So Ted seems to be an accelerationist. He wants to knit the whole global system together through international agreements and common global currencies and, you know, NAFTA type agreements that go global, just to interlink the whole system because he wants it all together when it goes in, the whole sucker goes in, right? So that's kind of, so, and he says this in the manifesto, he's promoting these global linkages to foster total collapse. But you're right. I mean, at a local level, if people are sort of resisting the system locally, resisting globalization, you know, out of their own interests, whatever, self-interest, ethnic interest, racial interests, in a sense, that's also resisting the system at a local, a more local level, something below the global level. And it's not really clear this balance between, you know, accelerationist, large scale and decelerationist, you know, smaller scale activities, you know, what's the right mix of strategies? You know, can we do both at the same time? Can we try to knit the system together while we're chopping down its roots at the bottom, so to speak, right? Can we, you know, plant little bombs along the way, even though we sort of, you know, paper over the big story and try to make everything look like it's all working together nicely. I mean, it's really a complicated matter, which I don't think Ted ever really completely spelled it out, and I don't think anybody has, how these different aspects, different strategic aspects play into one another, because it seems to be that you could work at multiple levels. If you just want to get rid of the system, you could sort of chop at it below. You could plant little bombs here and there. You could sort of, you know, dissuade people from joining the system, and you could work at a high level to try to link things all together. So it could really get sort of a complicated multi-level strategy, I think, at the worst case, to really sort of try to attack this monster at multiple levels at the same time. And I kind of think that's maybe what you're alluding to here, Greg. You know, one level we serve opposing technology, but another level maybe we're not doing the highest level things that Ted might be calling for.
Right.
You know, you really kind of need a systematic top to bottom analysis of how best to tackle this monstrosity, and then maybe we could bring some clarity to these issues, because it really is a complicated situation.
Right. One thing I would say is that we don't need to urge the system along in its globalizing telos. It's built in, it's baked in, and it's moving forward anyway. And therefore, we can say that, as they love to say, there is no alternative. There's no alternative to this on the global level. And therefore, I don't think we need to worry about that. One thing that strikes me about Kaczynski's attitude here is it's very much like Marx. Marx really wanted capitalism and colonialism to seize and control the entire globe so that the revolution would happen all at once. And he sort of has the same view. My view is that that's going to happen anyway, and that we should resist everywhere that we can, Heidegger has this notion of earth, the earth element. He talks about it in The Origin of the Work of Art. And the earth is just basically everything that resists presence and availability. And presence and availability are the things that technology is supposed to secure for us. And so everything has this earthy dimension, and the earth dimension for him is just sort of like a symbol of the resistance of the world to technological domination. If technology wants to make everything plastic, then earth is the thing that resists everything becoming plastic and present and available and consumable. And there are a million little ways that we can, in our daily life, affirm the earthy over the plastic. And anything in any little act of resistance, I think, whether it's slow food rather than fast food, or declining to get on board the latest technologies, declining to get swept up on the latest current thing, whatever we do, I think is admirable, and it certainly can't hurt. And so I would think that promoting every form of difference, every form of how to put it, everything that's romantic, everything that is non-utilitarian, the beautiful over the useful, the charming and quaint over the convenient and practical, any tendencies to do that is a form of resistance to the technological system. And I think it needs to be applauded. And I think nationalism and romanticism and sort of mystical and religious attitudes towards nature, all of these things are countervailing forces to technological domination.
There's a difference between what you do in your personal life and your public face, I think, is what Ted would say. Mm-hmm. So sure, if you've got your personal, you need to maintain your personal sanity, then you probably better limit your technology. If you're worried about your kids growing up and don't want them to be fanatics or whatever, you better clamp down on the screen time and don't give them cell phones and so forth. So in your private life, say in your family life, yeah, totally agree, right? You want to kind of maintain your own sanity, you want to protect your family, protect your kids. But Ted would issue a warning, like, that's not a good model for the world, because if we relieve people's stress, if we get them out on weekends, out in nature, and they feel a little bit better, they may decide that it's okay to keep the system going, right? Mm-hmm. Ted was all about increasing stress, right? He's like, we need to make people feel really uncomfortable about how the system is going, because they don't even really don. They just think it's a good stuff. Oh, it's fun to have a cell phone. It's nice to have cars. And what would I do without my computer? And I like having airplanes because I can fly around to nice vacations. And people don't even understand the total catastrophe of these things. So Ted's like, people need to feel the stress. If you want to de-stress them, you're only prolonging the system from continuing. You're not making people feel the pain that they need to feel. You know what I'm saying? I use an example. I used to talk about this in my class all the time. I talk to the students like, why doesn't relieving the pain help is a good thing? And I said, pretend you have lung cancer and you've got chest pain and you go to the doctor and you tell him about your pain and he says, here, take some extra strength Tylenol. And you do it and it goes away. Well, okay, cool, right? And then you go back a few weeks later and like, hey, this pain is still here. Oh, I'm going to give you some super OxyContin. That'll do it. And it goes away, right? Okay, so I'm relieving the stress. I feel good for a while, right? But is the doctor helping me? No, he's killing me, right? Because he's not addressing the root cause. Mm-hmm. So as long as we allow people to continue on without addressing the root cause, even if we make things sort of easier or more tolerable for people in a public sense, we may actually be doing a bad thing. We may be prolonging this system when we need to have people feel the pain. People need to, whatever. I don't know what Ted would say, join the resistance movement, radically crash out, striking out in their own ways, whatever it might be. Only if they feel the pain will they do that, because if they're comfortable and relatively blind to these problems, they're just going to continue on as they have been. And then the system will continue to grow in strength. So it's, again, it's a really, I think it's a complicated question about, public versus private, what you do for yourself versus, you know, strategies that you might recommend for larger populations. There's just a lot of aspects to this.
Let me ask you, you edited a volume of Savitri Devi, her book on Akhenaten, Son of God. Did you ever ask Kaczynski about her, or did you ever send a copy of Impeachment of Man or get his thoughts on that particular individual? She was definitely a radical ecologist.
Yeah, no, never mentioned her. I don't think I was really even understood much about her at the time when we were doing most of our correspondence. You know, the most I would have done is I would have passed along to Ted explicitly anti-tech philosophers, which I thought was interesting throughout history, just to show the trends and how things have developed. You know, Devi, I mean, she was a kind of a primitivist, I think, but I don't know that she was in any sense an anti-tech. Maybe she was a kind of an anti-civ person. I don't really know. But yeah, no, there was no discussion between him and myself about her.
So can you name any other thinkers on technology that influenced Kaczynski besides Ellul?
That's a good question. I think Ellul was the big one. You know, I threw some quotes at him by people like Illich and Mumford, and he tended to poo-hoo those things. I know I sent him some stuff by Illich, and he's like, this guy's a terrible writer. I don't even understand what he's talking about. You know, Illich is right a little bit of obscure way. I didn't even bother with Heidegger because that's kind of, you know, real gibberish the way Heidegger writes. You know, I don't know. Ted was like, I mean, he wasn't really interested in the history. I thought that was really kind of fascinating, these developing ideas, these parallel structures. Short of Ellul, I mean, you know, Ellul was really kind of a one of a kind in what he did. And Ted was interested in research that supported his ideas. So he talked about, you know, scholars in primitive societies and ideas like learned helplessness, psychological things that related to power process and so forth. Those were the kind of people that he wanted to hear about, you know, not philosophers, not tech thinkers, because Ted's got it figured out. I mean, right. You know, Ted knows what he knows, and he doesn't need anybody else's ideas. He's got it all figured out. So he was very confident, if I could just put it that way, in his own views. So he didn't need to hear that. He needed to hear about psychology and maybe anthropology, things he didn't really know about. He was interested to see that as it supported his thesis, and that was really all that he wanted to hear about.
Was he at all influenced by Nietzsche? Because his analysis of the power process and his analysis of the psychology of leftism strikes me as very consistent with a lot of central ideas that Nietzsche had about the will to power and about slave morality, resentment, and so forth, as motives for both Christianity and also the left.
Yeah, we brought up Nietzsche a couple times. I'm a big Nietzsche fan. I taught Nietzsche for a while at Michigan. And you're right, a lot of interesting parallel structures or some nice anti-tech passages by Nietzsche. And I think Ted, you know, Ted found little inspirational quotes. That was maybe one person that Ted would quote once in a while. And it was pretty rare. But he would quote like Nietzsche on freedom. Nietzsche's sort of like, you know, a free man is a warrior. You know, you don't just get freedom. You have to fight for it. And Ted liked that. So he grabbed a couple of these passages that he liked from Nietzsche about, you know, the need for I don't know if he even talked about master morality, but things that were consistent with the need for exerting one's will. I mean, in the sense of will to power, that it takes forceful action to earn one's freedom. And I think, you know, there was a couple bits in Nietzsche that Ted liked. But again, that was very, very rare that he would do that.
Thomas Steuben has written in, and he asked about the Butlerian jihad. This is from the backstory of David Lynch did the first movie, Frank Herbert's Dune. Dune is set in very, very distant future, and in the backstory, civilization had been basically, and human beings had been enslaved by artificial intelligences, and that the human race had risen up against that and had reverted to a kind of earlier form of civilization that was quasi-feudal. They had a religious ban against thinking machines and artificial intelligence, and had instead developed human capacities to a very high degree. I think it's a fascinating backstory to a fascinating sci-fi universe. I guess the first question is, did Kaczynski ever read Frank Herbert?
Again, not to my knowledge. I'm trying to think if there were any fiction, even, you know, sort of relevant science fiction. My God, offhand, I can't think of any cases where we talked about that.
Yes, science fiction is, for me, one of the sources for my anxiety and about technology. So, you know, and it's all of its dystopian potential. And so I wonder more broadly if he had any inspiration from sci-fi, but apparently not, at least not to your knowledge.
Why was it a Butlerian jihad? Is that going back to Samuel Butler?
Well, no, it's a good question. That's what I would have thought initially. No, the name of a particular character, I think the name was Serena Butler or something like that. But maybe he chose the name Butler thinking of Samuel Butler, which is
Samuel Butler did advocate. He was the first to advocate revolution against the machines, right? This is like in 1856 or something. So, you know, Darwin Against the Machines was one of his essays. So that's a little too coincidental. I'm suspecting, you know, Frank Herbert maybe knew what he was doing when he put a character Butler in there. So
I think you're absolutely right. I think that makes a lot of sense. I do feel that we are coming to a point where humanity is going to have a jihad, a holy war against thinking machines, if we're going to have a future at all. And when I was recently doing a lot of reading, because all of my friends are saying, oh my God, look at ChatGPT, and look, it wrote a poem, and oh, it's actually a good poem, and look what it says about you. And it's programmed to tell lies and engage in pretzel logic about certain hot button issues that its programmers don't want it to think about. It's just fascinating. And I said, you know, I've really got to start thinking about this more. And so I started reading about the worst case scenarios for AI, and it rapidly became extremely agitating. And I started thinking, Ted was right. I need to pick up Ted Kaczynski again. Ted was right. Maybe it will be the Kaczynskian jihad someday. That will be the thing
absolutely.
That overthrows the machines.
Exactly. I said that. In fact, I wrote that in the introduction to his book that came out back in 2010. I said, basically, you know, there's a good chance Ted's going to seem like a prophet and maybe a savior if we do something, because, you know, he called for the explicit action against the machine, against the system. And that is probably what it's going to take. You know, I keep wondering myself what it's going to take to get people to do something. I guess my most hopeful scenario is we have a near miss catastrophe, right? Like we had like COVID, right? So COVID was kind of this big global disaster, but you know, how many people in total died from COVID? What was it? A few million or something? I mean, that's just a blip on the radar compared to how many, you know, we're adding every year. I think we need a near catastrophe that maybe kills a billion people. And then we survive that one and people think, oh my God, that could have been like, you know, all billion of us. And we're lucky there's only 1 billion. Maybe we should do something now before the next disaster comes around. I mean, I kind of hate to think about it that way, but it's going to take a real slap in the face, a major catastrophic but recoverable disaster. You know, we collectively get shocked into our senses and think, well, that's never going to happen again. And there's only one way to stop that, and that's to bring the system down. So,
optimistic scenario.
That's my optimistic talk, right? Where we lose a billion people and we save the other seven or whatever, you know. But again, I mean, that's such a fine line between a, you know, a disaster that kills a billion and kills all of us. I mean, that's such a fine line. And to hit just that right amount, just that right level of disaster, you know, the chances are dwindling. So I'm not terribly optimistic.
Yeah, well, people don't listen to reason. They don't listen to warnings. They generally only learn from suffering. And so it's not rational based on historical induction to be very optimistic about these sorts of things, I'm afraid.
And I wonder why more people aren't talking about it. I mean, that's the thing. Even it's worth having the discussion in any case, no matter what side you come down on, it's worth having the discussion. But nobody is willing to have this discussion. I mean, you and I are, but you know, nobody wants to talk about this. If they don't want to contemplate, you know, extreme action, they don't want to talk about revolution, they don't want to weigh the pros and cons. Nobody wants to do this. You know, you hear critics pipe up in the news about AI. I sent a note to Max Tegmark, who was a prominent critic. Maybe you saw he had some pieces against AI recently. Mm-hmm. I sent an email to him. I said, hey, Max, we need to put together a group of people who are like serious anti-tech critics and take the strongest possible views and debate these things. No answer. Max can't be bothered to respond to me. You know, so I mean, like, what the hell? You know, you can't even get these people to engage in a discussion. That's how bad it is. It's a bad situation. Yeah, I don't know. Hard to know how to even respond to that blindness.
Well, I like to end on a positive note when I do these streams, but I'm sort of drawing a blank here because we are confronting some terrible possibilities. We're confronting the possibility of human extinction through human hubris and folly, where most of us are just along for the ride, while there are incredibly arrogant people in positions of power and in scientific institutions, authoritative institutions that are pushing forward AI, and they're pushing forward a lot of other potentially very dangerous technologies. There doesn't seem to be any oversight. One of the most laughable things that I read, I laughed lest I cried about it, because one of the things I read is that one of the people that are pushing forward AI development thought that maybe once the AI was sufficiently developed, then they could use the AI to come up with protocols to control for any AI-created disasters. I just thought, The sheer stupidity of highly intelligent people could be the end of the human race. So anyway, let me just say this. Well, I would love to at least have more conversations like this with you. We should definitely explore this some more, because I think it's extremely important. I'm getting your book on technology. I'm going to read it. And maybe we could do another live stream where we talk about your particular work on technology.
Yeah. If I could, just for the benefit of the readers, there are actually two books that I put out that are maybe relevant. One is called Confronting Technology, and it's a reader. It's a collection of historical critiques of technology going back to ancient Greece. So I think it's a really fascinating study. Almost nobody knows about it. You know, big name thinkers through history that have criticized technology. So this is not a recent idea. It's not like we just dreamt this up the other day. No, it's been around for, you know, 2,500 years at least. So that's one book, Confronting Technology. The other book is I wrote myself a monograph called The Metaphysics of Technology. That's a more of a philosophical book published by Routledge 2015. And that really lays out kind of the strong metaphysical basis for technological determinism and how we might grapple with it. And I really think that, again, that's really sort of something that no one has really done. They really haven't talked about technology as a philosophical or metaphysical entity. So I mean, it's interesting reading. Certainly would be a great thing to talk about, Greg, in the future. You want to look at either of those aspects. We could do some historical takes, so we could kind of tackle my own philosophical views and see what people think about that as well.
Yeah, I would enjoy that. To end, let's wrap up by talking about Ted Kaczynski again. You started corresponding with him, you said, in 2003, or was about that time? Did you continue to be in contact with him to the end of his life?
Not until the end. I mean, we got through, you know, 2004, 2005, 2006, into the publication of the first edition of his book, which came out 2009, 2010. That was our heavy correspondence. Once the book was out, then things kind of tailed off. We had less frequent contact. I was going off in sort of my own different directions. Ted started working with his publisher directly, so we had less occasion to interact. So actually, it's been a few years. I mean, I'm trying to think, the last letter I got from him has probably been 5 or 6 years at this point. It's been a few years since we had we had our last correspondence. I've kept tabs through people, the few people that he did talk through, mostly through his publisher at Fitch and Madison, who's done the latest edition of his book. So I've kept tabs indirectly, helped him out indirectly, because there was some need for indirect help for quite a while. But we kind of just stopped corresponding a few years ago.
So will you publish your complete correspondence with him someday?
That's a good question. I'm hoping to. We've got several, like I said, dozens, well over 100 letters. The book Technological Slavery by Kaczynski has many of his letters to me. So you've read it. Some people have read it. About a quarter of that book is letters to David Skrbina. So he's responding to my challenges and queries in his letters. What you don't see is my letters to him. So what's the case that I'm making? What am I pressing him on? To me, it would be really interesting, and this has been done in history, is to have the actual correspondence back and forth between himself and myself. And I've already raised that possibility with the publisher. We're going to take some initial steps now that the Ted's gone to see if we can publish large sections of our correspondence, if it makes sense, if it's helpful. I think it is helpful. Really kind of shows the development of ideas. It really helps to humanize Ted, shows how kind of rational and careful of a thinker he was, and most times how kind of, you know, common sense and even courteous he was. I mean, he was sort of a polite and respectful fellow virtually all the time. So yeah, I do hope at some point to publish those, at least a portion of those letters from both myself and him.
I think it would be wonderful if somebody, perhaps you, perhaps his publishers, would come up with a listing of all the correspondence that he had and try and collect a lot of the letters that he sent out. He was in prison for more than 20 years and corresponded extensively with people. I think that his correspondence should be kept and published someday, because I think it's quite interesting just from the history of ideas point of view. This also brings me to another question. Now that his life has come to an end, there really should be a biography of Ted Kaczynski. And collecting his correspondence would, I think, be one of the first things that anyone would do to do a really adequate biography, especially an intellectual biography. You know, it's easy enough to do a kind of Wikipedia biography of facts and times and dates and things like that. But this guy, after he went to jail, he led the life of the mind to the extent that he led any life at all. And somebody really needs to write an intellectual biography of this man. And I hope that somebody does him justice someday. That would be a fascinating book to read.
Well, you know, there's tons of stuff, right? Because we have a archive at the University of Michigan. There's an anarchist library, basically, and there's a giant file on Ted Kaczynski. And for years, he's been sending to the library his mail, his correspondence, some of his, you know, old essays, early book manuscripts. I mean, there are dozens of boxes of material that are in this archive. So there's no shortage of stuff to draw from. If somebody wanted to go through and had permission, the other problem is permission to use these things and to reproduce them in book form. I don't know exactly what the rules are going to be going forward on those. Depends on who owns the copyrights to all the stuff, and it's not really clear to me who does at this point. But the material is there. It's publicly available because that's the nature of the library. So the Hatcher Graduate Library at University of Michigan has tons of material for those who are motivated and want to do exactly what you're saying. The stuff is there, and it needs to be pulled and read through. And I'm sure someone or some people will do it at some point.
Well, that's very encouraging. I'm glad there's already a substantial publicly available collection of his writings. That's a very good start. That'll save somebody a lot of time. I've done biographical research that's ongoing about Savitri Devi, and it's extremely frustrating when somebody dies, and generally within 20 years of a thinker's death, if you haven't gathered together surviving correspondence, it starts disappearing rapidly. Correspondents die, their children are in a hurry, things get dumped because people don't know the value of it, and on and on and on. History disappears very rapidly unless somebody takes responsibility to preserve it. So, David, I'd like to wrap up. Can you tell people how they can learn more about your work and follow your work?
Well, right. So, I mean, a lot of my books are available, readily available on Amazon and whatnot. I've got a personal website, davidscribina.com, and I try to keep that up to date so people can track things there as well. Yeah, I think that's probably the best source right now. I mean, there's various essays and articles that I've published out there, and probably just generic internet searches will find them. But yeah, particularly on the problem of technology and TED, that's pretty well documented. I think I've got most of that listed in my website. So that's the best source.
Well, thank you so much. I want to thank our listeners out there. I want to thank the donors who sent in super chats. I want to thank our moderators. We will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. We're going to do another live stream, and I'm going to be beginning a 5 live stream series where I'm going to take people through Plato's dialogue, The Gorgias. This is something that I have been meaning to do for a long time, and I was reviewing an old lecture course that I did on The Gorgias back in the 90s, and I started thinking, you know, this is actually really good. And beyond that, it's also quite relevant. The theme of it is going to be might versus right. The Gorgias, I think, is one of the best introductions to Plato. And I would like to lead you through it very, very carefully in 5 sessions. So there's more information about this at Countercurrents, about how we're going to go about this. So if you would like to take part in this, anybody can take part. It's just going to be free out there on the web. But if you could read the opening of the dialogue, read Socrates' initial conversation with the great sophist Gorgias. We will be discussing that in the first lecture a week from today. So, David, again, thank you so much. And I would love to have you back when I have a chance to read both of your books, the anthology and also the metaphysics of technology, because there's a lot, obviously, to be said about these issues. And it's nothing could be more timely because we're talking about the dwindling future prospects of the human race.
Yeah, it's not going away. It's only going to get worse. So we're going to have plenty of chance to talk. So I'm happy to do it anytime, Greg. Thanks.
Thank you so much.